here in the moment on SDPV. I'm Susie Hansen. The Moth has just celebrated its 20th anniversary. That's right, for 20 years, the Moth has been collecting and sharing stories. 25,000 stories, to be exact, all shared live without notes. Maybe you've been a fan of the Moth Radio Hour that airs every Sunday night here on SDPB, but did you know the Moth does a lot more than that? I spoke with Catherine Burns, the artistic director of the Moth, and asked her about the very first Moth event.
The first Moth Night happened on June 6, 1997. Our founder, George Doss Green, was a writer, and he had grown up on an island off the coast of Georgia where he and his friends would sit around on a friend of his porch, and they would play poker and tell stories. And when he got to New York City, he really missed those nights on the porch, and so he decided he wanted to recreate that feeling, and he invited a bunch of friends over to his house for an evening of stories. And we could talk about that more, but that's how it began. So originally, the Moth was what we call our main stage, where we invite five people from all walks of life to come tell a 10 to 12 minute story on stage in front of a live audience. And we actually work with those storytellers and help them craft their stories. They're not memorized, but we help work out the beats because 10 minutes tends to go by really fast. Mm-hmm. Then there was such an amazing response to the series that more people wanted to tell stories than the Moth back then, the producers had room for. So they started an open mic story slam competition where anyone could come. A theme would be announced in advance, and people would put their names in the hat. They wanted to tell a story, and the first 10 people got to tell five-minute stories. And then the stories were, the way I would like to refer to it is they were lovingly judged by the crowd. And it was a contest, and now those are actually have grown. Originally, they were in New York City, and now they're actually in 27 cities around the world. And then almost from the beginning, there was a desire to really give back to the community. And so they started doing community workshops where they would go into a homeless shelter or at the time it might be a high school or like anywhere there might be storytellers that wouldn't naturally come to us. And they would go and do workshops free of charge in the communities. And, part of it was just to give back to the communities, and part of it was to try to find storytellers, who wouldn't come to us, who might then have a wonderful story to tell that could be featured on our main stage. So the community program grew up with us, and eventually it split off where we now have a community program, and then we also have a separate education program where we mostly focus on high school students.
Hmm.
I mean, that's mostly in New York City, but we occasionally do events outside the city. I mean, we'd love to expand it more. It's one of those things where we do it free of charge. Mm-hmm. So it's all about fundraising, being able to expand it. They also offer like curriculum for teachers to do it themselves, anywhere in the world. And it's a pretty wonderful program. We also have a corporate program where we will teach storytelling to corporations. And it's actually a really wonderful program that we love. And some amazing storytellers have come out of that too. But part of the philosophy is we teach storytelling, to big corporations, and then the money we take helps pay for all the workshops that we want to do with the kids or, people with disabilities or different groups mm-hmm. that we might want to reach. So it works out pretty well. All of these programs produce wonderful stories. And in 2008, we actually launched our podcast, and that took off pretty quickly, partly thanks to the love of Mr. Ira Glass, who played some of the stories on his radio show and mentioned our podcast.
I wonder how many things in public radio grew out of the love of Ira Glass, really.
I should say, thanks to him. He showed us love by putting our stories on his amazing show, and then people found us that way. And to this day, so many people tell me that they first found out about the Moth from This American Life. So we're forever grateful to Ira and everyone at This American Life. We've been in talks with PRX, who are our wonderful partners, about possibly doing a radio show. And with the success of the podcast, it was a good time to do it. We also met the great Jay Allison, who was interested in making us his next project after This, I Believe, which was just, when you have a brilliant man that you love who has five Peabody's on his shelf, you're like, yes, please. Mm-hmm. And so the radio show launched in 2009, and it went weekly, I believe, in 2013.
PRX is the Public Radio Exchange, and Jay Allison is producer extraordinaire.
Yes, he is.
Where did the name come from? Why is it the Moth?
So I was talking about George sitting around in that porch in Georgia with his friends. There was a hole in the screen, and moths would flutter around. And they started calling themselves the Moths. You know, they'd say, the Moths will meet tonight. And so he kept that name when he moved to New York City. We also sometimes like to say that people are drawn to stories like Moths to a Flame. But really, the name came from the Moths fluttering around George and his friends on that Georgian porch.
Okay, let's talk about the act of storytelling itself. Why is it important that we tell stories?
Well, I think it's important for us to find meaningful ways to connect. You know, it's like, it's no secret that we live in this increasingly digital world, and we're kind of putting our best selves forward on Facebook or sending our best friend off a quick little tweet, you know, or like, I mean, or a text. And it's just, I don't think that our bodies have evolved to be completely satisfied by that, and that people still desperately want to connect in meaningful ways with their friends and neighbors. And I actually think that that's the reason, you know, the success of the Moth is not just the story of the success of the moth. One of the things that we love is that the Moth has inspired and sort of spawned thousands and thousands of other storytelling organizations around the world. And we really think of it as like a modern storytelling movement. And I don't think there's any coincidence that it came up hand in hand with the digital age. I mean, one of the things that I think unites all Moth audiences is that all they want is for the person to be themselves, you know, for the person to go up there and just be their best possible version of themselves. And what I mean by that is their most authentic, not their perfect. Like, they don't want to hear the story necessarily about the time you were a hero. You know, they just want to see the real you. Just about the only way you can bomb at the Moth is to go up there and be super memorized and performancey. Like, every now and then we have people who do one-man shows and tell stories, and some of them are wonderful, but yeah, every now and then you get that one that gets up there and they just go into total performance mode. The second they do that, the audience starts to see and treat them like a performer, and it doesn't usually go well from there, you know, because all the audience wants is for them to be real. And that's true whether it's like a final performance at a corporate retreat that we're leading, or a slam at a high school, or a program in a prison.
So this is the one place where if you're not real and pretty raw, it's not going to go well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, raw is an interesting word because, you know, what you do want people to be really real. You don't want people to be, like, to get up there and have it feel like therapy.
Sure. Good point.
And that's a tricky thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things is you just want to make sure the person's really ready to tell the story. You know, you want them to be up there and be really in their emotion, in their experience. But one of the things, another thing that where the Moth can sometimes go wrong is if someone's telling a story before they've really processed it. And part of our jobs as directors and producers is trying to help people assess whether or not they're ready to tell a story. And some people might be ready to tell a story really quickly. And for other people, you know, I had one storyteller who I was trying to get to tell a story. He had a gorgeous story. She was a child of a kinder transport in World War II, you know, and escaped to England as a little girl. And she couldn't not really even tell her own story nearly 70 years later because it was still too painful for her. Mm. And so for some people, you know, 6 months might be enough, and for another person, 70 years might not be enough.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about this process, because I think most of our audience is most familiar with the radio show that comes out of the Moth organization. So what happens before we hear a story over the radio?
So when, you know, there's many ways that we find our storytellers, but when we're introduced to someone new, especially if we have reason to think they might have a great story, but we don't know exactly what that story might be, usually we get together with them in person, or we might hop on the phone and talk to them about what their stories might be. And one of the things I often say to people is, like, what are the stories that you tend to repeat to your friends? Or what are the stories that your friends ask you to tell to their friends, you know, when you're out at dinner? Because sometimes those stories are quite anecdotal, but there's often something in them that where there'll be sort of a grain of truth about that person, and there's something that you can build on. Like, there'll be a reason why that's the story the person gets asked to tell again and again. And so then once we identify the story, I mean, all of our directors have a slightly different process, but what I like to do is hang up the phone with them, and then I write an outline for them and email it to them, because I find that people find it helpful to hear somebody else tell them their story back to them. And yeah, I don't write it all the way out. It's just bullet points, maybe, you know, 10 or 12, like one bullet point per minute. But I find it's easier for them to react off to what I've written than it is for them to try to do an outline on their own, because it might be so overwhelming for them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the two of us will kind of tweak it back and forth until we end up with the outline that they feel really good about. Because inevitably I'll get something wrong, or there'll be a question I have that they need to answer. And then once we get that outline, I will again get together with the person in person or either on the phone and have them tell me the story as best they can. And they're allowed to look at my outline at that point. And I jokingly call this the free to suck version, because I just want them to get it out of their mouth, you know, more or less in order, and not be too worried about it. It can be very hard to tell it the first time. And people go average, you know, 15, 20 minutes usually in this version. And then we just continue to, you know, tighten it and pull it down. What we're trying to do is, like, get rid of all the extraneous details that don't really support the story, so that the heart of the story is really prominent. Then we actually do an official rehearsal with all the other storytellers and members of our staff. They each tell the story to each other, and then we go on to the main live show. But that's done in, like, a conference room or, you know, in someone's living room. It's not done on the stage, the rehearsal.
So I know I only have a few minutes left. I just have two questions left.
Okay.
First one, after we hear your interview in the show, then we're going to hear the 20th anniversary episode.
Hooray!
Play the single file version. So
yeah.
Can you set that up a little bit, or tell me a little bit about how those stories were chosen for this special episode?
Well, it's funny. We were trying to figure out exactly how to best do that episode. And at first, we thought it would be fun to do, like, you know, a story from maybe the first 7 years, second 7 years, and last, you know, 6 years, you know, to do it that way. But then some of members of our media team said, well, what if we actually picked out stories that had feel very set in time, you know, that like, so you pick out a story that takes place in the late 90s and the story that, you know, takes place in the early 2000s, and then a story that is very modern and now. And Sarah Austin Jeunesse, who hosted the episode, thought that was so funny. And so they ended up with a story called Anthony the Hat, which is by Richie DeSalvo, who actually we met in a homeless shelter back in early 2002. But he got on his feet, and he died recently, but, like, got out of the shelter and really got back on his feet and lived an amazing life. But we originally met him there through our community program, and he told a story about, I don't want to give it away too much, but I feel like about being sort of purchased a pizzeria by the mob in Brooklyn in the late 90s and everything that happens there. And then we had a fun story about Jesse Klein, who is now a pretty well-known writer and comedian. She's the showrunner for Inside Amy Schumer. But the story is called Breaking Up in the Age of Google. And in front of the live audience, and she told the story back in 2002, she had to actually define Google, because there were some people in the audience that didn't know what it was to Google.
Uh-huh.
I know, it's so crazy to think about
it's
now.
Like a time capsule.
She's a brilliant thing that allows you to stalk someone from the confines of your own home, I think that's what she says. And then the last story is from this wonderful woman named Sasaki, who we actually met. We have an international community program now where we do work across Africa. We do it, you know, working with the Gates Foundation. And her story is about her being an AIDS activist in South Africa, growing up there, and, like, realizing that what is needed to help the people around her is different from what she originally thought. And it ultimately is a tribute to the power of being willing to stop and listen. And we thought, that's the most Moth thing we've ever heard. So we'll close our 20th anniversary episode with a story that's really about the power and, you know, the healing power of listening.
Okay, last question. I know you have to go. In all your time, experiences, all the stories you've heard, everything you've done with the Moth, what has surprised you the most?
That is a good question. What has surprised me the most? We were initially surprised at how well it worked outside of New York. Maybe I shouldn't say that. You know, there were a lot of us that wondered, like, is this just a little New York-y thing? Is this just like a New York literary world thing? And then I'll never forget one of the first big shows that I ever saw outside of New York. We did it in New Haven, Connecticut. And we found that within 5 minutes, the audience was just like our new audience. They were so smart. They were so kind. We call it sometimes when somebody's telling a story that's really quiet as opposed to a loud, funny story. we call it the sound of the audience leaning in, where you just feel that people are hanging on at the person's every word and listening so respectfully. And that it felt like we might as well have been in our regular venue in New York City, but instead we were in like this funny club in New Haven. And we're like, wow, you know, maybe this translates in an even bigger way than we thought. And then we did our first national tour in 2006 and 2007, and we just found that wherever we went, there the audiences were. And then, weirdly, I did a Moth. This is one of my favorite Moths I've ever done. In 2008, I did a Moth in Dushanbe, Tajikistan, which is as crazy and random as it sounds. And again, like the whole audience shows up, and you know, half the women are wearing these beautiful traditional headdresses that they wear there. And I'm looking out. Half the story was in, part of it was in English with translation, but part of it was in Russian. There were some bits in Tajik. And I was like, how is this going to go? 5 minutes later, if it not for the outfits and like the setting and the words that were being spoken in a foreign language, it might as well have been in, again, our venue that we had been doing shows in New York City for years and years. And so I think there really is just something universal about this desire to sit and listen to somebody tell a story. And we discovered that early on, and I think that's what's actually allowed us to expand around, was the discovery that people really do want this everywhere. I mean, we found out a few years ago that there had been sort of a Moth tribute show in Antarctica, like in the bar. And we're like, that's so amazing. We're so in love with it. So it's like no matter where you go. So, I mean, I think in hindsight I shouldn't have been surprised by that, but I'm delighted by that.
Catherine Burns, the artistic director of The Moth. Learn more at themoth.org. The Moth Radio Hour airs on SDPB Sunday nights at 8 Central, 7 Mountain. And if you missed last night's 20th anniversary episode, well, you're in luck. We're re-airing that show in a few minutes. It's the second hour of today's In the Moment.